Welcome to Dark Mood Woods, a Twin Peaks podcast. This is Ethan.
This is Nick.
And joining us this week is...
Dougie. No, actually, Keith Euler.
thank you, Keith, for joining us. It was a pleasure. Anyway, we've got, as opposed to the past two episodes, we have 1 hour of content to talk about. And I think maybe this is even a bit of a starting off point, is how 2 weeks ago, essentially, we had this four-hour bomb dropped on us of content. And then there was kind of a two-week waiting period of the internet memeing the show to death. And now we're here kind of in what I'd call the slow drip process of, again, an hour every week until the end of the summer. So how have we spent these 2 weeks?
So, yes, last week, realizing there would not be a new episode of Twin Peaks, I decided to stave off the hunger a little bit and rewatch the first four episodes, which I would have done in between them and this fifth part anyway. I think largely because the first four episodes, as I had sort of indicated in our original recordings, were such a whirlwind experience as far as the viewing goes, because you've been waiting so long for this and finally you have it. And when it's unspooling in front of you, it's hard to focus on it in a completely critical, attended way. There's sort of this constant shock and surprise at even the smallest thing. So it felt necessary to revisit the first four broadcasts. And lo and behold, it held up very well. I'm not necessarily surprised to say that, since I quite liked it. I am pleased that the many twists and turns that unfolded did not necessarily lose their impact for whatever reason. Perhaps it was the force of the anticipation, where I was still very delighted and somehow even still kind of surprised when we have Alpha Coop's introduction set to the David Lynch remix of a song called American Woman. Turns out not the song by Guess Who. I had originally thought that, and I was very confused because listening to it, I thought this sounds absolutely nothing like the classic Guess Who song.
Or Lenny Kravitz,
for that matter. Yes.
Yeah. Muddy Magnolias.
Muddy Magnolias, that's right. And, you know, the humor of Wally Brando remains strong. And the surprise of Dougie Jones, sort of the confusion held up there. And I found myself picking up a number of things. And what was perhaps most satisfying about it was the experience of watching part five last night, seeing how many things were kind of clicking into place in ways that are ways that to me evince a very intricate assembly and a very kind of click-clack rhythm as far as the sequencing of the show itself goes. So yeah, it's going to be a little strange going forward 1 hour at a time. I think especially, before we get into the review too much, I'll say, I think especially because I've seen a number of people already, even assessing the episode positively, call it essentially a number of scenes, which I think is a little unfair. I think there is kind of a clear arc to the episode from beginning to end, from first scene to last, but it does, to my mind, seem to be moving a lot faster in a way, not just because it's 1 hour as opposed to two. Even watching the first, second, third, fourth episode essentially separately, there was this experience now where it feels like we're really getting into it, where it's kind of gliding forward now. And I was kind of surprised when we had reached the roadhouse at the end, even though that wasn't quite the end of the episode.
Yeah.
I still found myself a bit swept up in a way that I didn't necessarily anticipate. So yeah, it will be fascinating. I think eventually we'll acclimate to it. I don't know if we'll necessarily... I wonder if the effect of the episodes playing as quite a lot of incident will change. And I don't necessarily want it to, because I was quite surprised watching this episode when we reached one of the last scenes, which kind of looped back around to the beginning, just how much had happened in this 55 or so minutes.
Yeah. No, it's... Yeah, it's going to be interesting, as you say, to kind of go along now with the hour long per week until and the 1 week off over July 4th weekend until the dual finale in September 3rd. As you kind of describing it like an atom, like a bomb being dropped on you with four of them all at once, or, you know, at least the ability to watch four at once is pretty apt, I'd say. It's just, you know, because all those four episodes are very different, too. Maybe one and two have something, have a bit of similarity in it, but then three goes like full avant-garde for the first 30 minutes and then gets completely crazily comic, you know, in the latter half of it. And then four kind of follows up on that. And five, what's interesting to it, you talked, Nick, about the kind of the not the stop-start nature. Or you were saying that people were saying that, I think, like, you know, it's a collection of scenes. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's always to a degree been Twin Peaks' raison d'etre, so to speak. It was based in soap opera, and so it always was a collection of scenes. And what that collection of scenes did was tweak soap operatic formula and everything. And also, I would say, with the collaboration between Mark Frost and David Lynch, kind of bring narrative and non-narrative impulses together in interesting ways. Something that this new season thus far, and which I gather will probably continue, makes even more interesting in terms of the dialogue that results. And I mean, sort of like the artistic dialogue, you know, and I guess also the literal dialogue too, because I know there have been some complaints about sometimes the expository nature of things, which doesn't bother me in the slightest, because usually if there's anything expository, it either follows something really profoundly beautiful, like when Shelley says right before, you know, Shelley says in the roadhouse and at the end of episode two that James is in a motorcycle accident. He's just quiet now, and then goes into James has been cool. James is cool. He's always been cool. So you have something like that, and then, or you have, you know, like a giant digital electrode shooting tree that's replaced Michael J. Anderson, you know, telling you the exposition. So it's kind of like, you know, this is not anything typical. You know, I would say it's anomalous even by the standards of, you know, of avant-garde and narrative art, at least as far as I can tell, though I'm certainly less up on avant-garde art than others may be. Nonetheless, I think that that sense of dialogues being developed and had, sometimes I'd say on, if not all the time, on multiple levels, as far as, you know, as far as even within individual scenes, I feel like there's layers to what's going on and what's being said. This week, in episode five, I just handed in my recap, and I sort of couched it around the image of Becky, who Amanda Seyfried plays, she's Shelley's daughter, although her last name, if you look in the credits, is not Briggs. It's Burnett, which is basically the name of her beau, played by Caleb Landry Jones, who I guess is her husband, according to this. But because she's listed as that, the father of who Becky is kind of, you know, obscured. It could most likely be Bobby Briggs, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's going to be some kind of twist as far as that goes. I couch my recap basically around the image of Becky in the car as she had her drug-fueled fantasy, basically, with this beautiful overhead shot and everything. And what I was most interested in this episode was how I thought, even though there's a lot of Cooper, Dougie, and Evil Cooper stuff in it, it seems very much to revolve around the women in a way that I found really intriguing and complicated. I know there's been some talk about how, like, for example, in the second episode, the henchwoman Daria is killed by Mr. C in the hotel room. And it's a very upsetting, violent thing that happens. And there's sort of a mirror scene here with in the Roadhouse towards the end, with the character who in the credits is listed as Richard Horn, who I assume is maybe Audrey Horn's son, kind of intrigues these women next to him, in the booth next to him. Then one of them comes over and he proceeds to curse her out and choke her and everything. And it's very ugly, very, very, very violent in its emotional violence, its physical violence, and that it comes so soon after a lot of very funny stuff, which I'm sure we can touch more on as we talk through this, is interesting. It reminded me a lot of the tonal switches in Fire Walk With Me, like from the Chet Desmond section to the Laura Palmer section, which I feel like is this amazing switch from black comedy to not funny at all. So that was kind of the thing around which I wrote my recap. I mean, in each week, I sort of try to discover what the wavelength is I access this on, because I think there's so many possible entry points. And whatever the plot points are, I kind of deal with them in the bullet point section below the main text, where in the main text, I sort of try to explicate the theme that was most of interest to me, but certainly not the only theme of interest. So I guess maybe throwing it to you, what were your all entry points into this one?
Well, it's interesting you brought up this is, you thought of the episode of Sitting Around the Women. What I think was interesting about this episode is how it really introduced millennials into Twin Peaks, and that we're now seeing all these generations, in particular, centering on Becky and Caleb Landry Jones here, who's Steven, right?
Mm-hmm.
Steven, yeah. How they're kind of the prototypical kind of, I mean, Steven's character introduction is him bombing a job interview. It seems like the show is explicitly getting into, it is, you could say, about America itself, and particularly about this new generation, this aimless generation. And it's interesting, I mean, I talk about this like kind of that political current, but then we get into another political current, which is Dr. Jacoby is Alex Jones, of course.
Yes.
And also, it's interesting in terms of political, I was thinking about how Cooper in the office now sort of, in a way that sort of rhymes, I feel like, with the casino section in certain obvious ways. But it was interesting watching that sequence again and realizing that maybe David Lynch has this, you could say, a contempt for corporate America in terms of how vague what Dougie's actual job is. And that you're at this business meeting where I feel like it's people who've probably never been in an office writing, the words coming out of Tom Sizemore's mouth are like, we made the transaction to the client for the sale or whatever. But those were my initial starting off points.
I feel like we should also mention that the man who's interviewing Steven, the Caleb Landry Jones character, is Mike Gary Hershberger from the original series, who was Bobby's good friend and fellow rabble rouser. So it's interesting to see how they both have become law abiding, so to speak. Although, as I said in my recap, it's interesting how the good doesn't entirely seem to fit them very comfortably, or the purported good, I suppose. And Mike even more so than Bobby. Bobby at least can still ugly cry with the best of them. Mike, on the other hand, seems very, I almost feel like he's David Byrne in The Too Big Suit, he's play acting a role. And I actually feel like there's probably a large degree of play acting that is going on here that's probably affected by some of the sci-fi-er elements of the premise and that may come to fruition down the road. Personally, I wouldn't be surprised if this entire series is taking place on the Garmin-Bosia planet that everybody keeps talking about or whatever, or that I've heard talked about by the diehard fans, let's say. That's also kind of Lynch. I mean, Lynch always, takes a view askew to things in every way. And it's just, I see more and more why the Showtime head calls this pure uncut Lynch, the pure heroin version, I think he said.
Nick?
Well, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, I felt that there was a sense of acceleration to this episode in a way, or perhaps more accurately, a ramping up and escalation, where now Dougie Jones / Cooper's experience in the real world is not him being confined to a casino or the back of a car or his house. Now he has to go out into the real world, and lo and behold, it is something of a disaster. I mean, I only say something because Lynch's corporate parody here, let's give credit. Lynch and Frost's corporate parody here is this vision where you can basically be, you know, sorry if I'm offending anybody when I say this term, but you can basically be severely autistic and still survive in the corporate world. Basically, you can have extreme disabilities where you can't understand or do anything, but people basically just say, well, you're acting a little odd, aren't you? And there's a certain rudeness that he exhibits by taking the coffee, by having somebody, by needing somebody to put him in a bathroom, by accusing the person of lying, by sort of not listening to his boss, and yet he still is sort of skating by. And this is all very funny, of course, but I do think there is a certain sadness that's underlying a lot of it, too. I mean, I was amused, certainly, by the final shot of the episode, which is him standing outside the statue, sort of inspecting the statue's feet for whatever reason. But if you really sit on the image for a second, it's kind of an unbearably sad idea. This guy is just trapped outside in this world he has no concept of, and the world is literally just passing him by, and the credits are rolling over him, and there's essentially zero indication as to how he's going to get out of this situation. And you have something as exhilarating as the overhead camera shot pullback on Amanda Seyfried as she does cocaine with the I wish I had the title of the song on tap, but I'll say that the song pretty explicitly brings to mind Mulholland Drive, particularly the sequence, the This Is the Girl sequence, when Justin Theroux's character is directing all the women singing. It's very much in that spirit, that sort of bubblegum beyond bubblegum pop music that's playing over the sequence. And it is essentially positioning her as a new Laura Palmer, the beautiful on the outside, poison on the inside girl who's dating a scummy guy who drives a fast car. Although Caleb Landry Jones is certainly no Bobby Briggs, I'll say. I do find it funny how between David Lynch and the Safdie brothers, I think a few other people, it's understood that Caleb Landry Jones is kind of an insistently unpleasant screen presence, and that should be mined for everything it's worth. Kind of the speed of things is intriguing me, or also how there's, you know, kind of this is the first time I think that the Evil Cooper character is starting to become a bit more visibly scary, where you're seeing the power that he's wielding in his call to quote-unquote Mr. Strawberry. And for some reason, of course it's not explained, the prison warden is visibly frightened by this. He's not confused, he's not intrigued, he's not shocked, he's visibly frightened by whatever power is being wielded here. And there's quite a bit that's going unexplained there, and I think even the introduction of perhaps he has somehow some psychic connection to these people, perhaps there's something else going on there. I found it sort of, for the most part, kind of an unrelentingly dark episode. It's just that a lot of it seemed to be humming right under the surface. The only possible levity, I think, is Dr. Jacoby, but even then, he's this insane old man who's living in the woods and is broadcasting some InfoWars-esque program in his free time. Basically, the extended sequences of him getting shovels and painting shovels were set up to pay off this ridiculous joke. And then, how can we forget that this paranoid guy in the woods, his ridiculous ad, $29.95, the gold shit-digging shovels, then cuts to an overhead shot of the Pentagon. that there is, and it relates to Garland Briggs, a character he knew. There is this weird direct line you can draw between this paranoid guy and these shady government dealings beyond our imagination. Yeah. Which, again, goes to the whole thing of how I'm more and more noticing the shape of the show. And it's interesting how I think that 5 hours in now, we can start to say more about the kind of the tone and the incident and the character, but still, as to what exactly is going on, it remains largely opaque, I would say. I mean, it's funny to imagine the way that televisual storytelling normally works, in that the previous episode climaxed with something of a cliffhanger, in that there's a woman in Twin Peaks who they know who she is, they know where she is ostensibly, who can identify Cooper, and there is nary a mention of that in this episode. you could watch this standalone and have no idea that there was anything of that sort going on.
Yeah. Also, I did want to follow up and say that the song that plays over Becky is I Love How You Love Me by the Paris Sisters. I've been collating a lot of the song cues into playlists and after every episode. So, I've been listening to these on and off and everything. it's interesting that you mentioned that, the thing about the humorous aspects. I mean, the smash cut to the Pentagon was just like, I thought I was really going to, die from laughter. It was so funny. But I mean, at the same time, Nick, you've talked about like drawing, that it draws these kind of clear narrative lines that even though, and that's again, kind of the conversation between, I think, the avant-garde impulses and the narrative impulses that are in this. I think where the avant-garde stuff often comes in is in the editing and such. And I now understand more and more why he wanted, double the amount of hours, I guess, that they were originally going to give him. As I'm to understand, I mean, he brought them a 450-page document, but Lynch sort of knew how it needed to be shaped in order for it to have an effect. And, that's a pure example, I guess, of sculpting in time, or at least having some idea of that. I feel all the cuts in this series more than I do most things, many movies too. It's clearly artistic intent is there. I would say probably comparable, if we're talking television, would be like the Nick or the Girlfriend Experience, because those are, Soderbergh and Lodge Kerrigan and Amy Simons, I think, have, their own kind of power of vision that comes through and cohesively and all that. It's interesting to get these through lines on things, and there's one shot that I want to talk about in the episode that really kind of moves me deeply, and it's ostensibly a plot scene where it's back to Hawk and Andy in the Twin Peaks Sheriff's office, and it's all like this slow dolly shot on them as they're going through the Laura Palmer evidence. And there's no dialogue at all until it gets closer to Andy. And then he says, Hawk, have you found any Indians? I haven't found any Indians. And Hawk is just like, no, I haven't, or something like that. And I feel like comparable to where I thought like the Wally Brando scene was kind of tweaking American exceptionalism and Manifest Destiny and other stuff like that. I feel like this is... it's kind of an acknowledgement to a degree of genocide and the country's history of that. It actually gave me a feeling of when I remember Jonathan Rosenbaum criticized the New World for not really mentioning explicitly the genocide of the Indians by the white races, and yet I felt in the New World what Terrence Malick did was, when he shows the tribe essentially being burned out of their villages and then just kind of moving off screen, that in and of itself implies the genocide that you then don't see. And suddenly the Indians were so prominent, or the Native Americans are so prominent, are no longer there. And so it's kind of like in the ellipses of things, an ellipsis can just give you this intense power, and a simple statement can bring up so many ideas and thoughts and resonances. And I just feel like with each episode so far, that's what I've been getting. And my usual experience of it is I watch it once at the premiere, just fully attentive. Then I sleep on it, and if I can sleep, which to be honest, I haven't been able to sleep at all. I wasn't able to sleep last night because there were associations and resonances kind of going around in my head, which makes me think it's going to be rather a difficult summer to a degree. We've got like, you know, what, 13 more hours of this. But I kind of felt that even after one episode, you know, on the first two episode premiere night. You know, that too is exciting. It's exciting to have this, you know, it's exciting when your mind races like that. And then comes the challenge of trying to connect it and trying to explicate things as to how you see it, and also kind of approaching it, realizing that you can never entirely tamp it down, which is, you know, part of what, why I think Lynch just kind of leaves things and talks cryptically so often, is it's really, he wants, you know, I'm sure he has his ideas, but he more wants to leave it for people to interpret themselves. And it's been interesting to see that, even though I guess there are, you know, what we'd call hot or bad takes on this, you know, which really just to me, like, boils down to bad writing. It's not necessarily the ideas behind it. It's the quality of the writing, which, you know, is done so quickly in so many cases and is so poorly thought through. You know, and that's kind of a challenge too. You know, I'm fortunate that I'm able to sleep on it, because I can't imagine having to, you know, immediately after the episode, write a recap and have it up by 1 a.m. you know, or midnight even, you know, basically doing it in 2 hours. I mean, the least amount of time it's taken me thus far is 6. And that's after a night's worth of, you know, attempted sleep and a rewatch of the episode and some note taking and reconsideration. You know, and I guess the other thing is that there's just many, you know, works of art that just aren't worth this level of thought, and it's nice to encounter one, frankly. So
stay tuned for our Billions podcast.
Oh, Jesus.
We should mention, I guess, this episode introduced, beyond just Becky and Steven, many new cast members, including Robert Knepper and Jim Belushi as the Mitchum brothers. And yep. I think one of the best scenes of the episode, which it's intercut, of course, Robert Knepper beating the crap out of Brett Gelman's casino boss character. It's intercutting Vegas showgirls kind of idly witnessing the event. And there's an interesting cut where it's very abruptly cut, the first one entering the room. And then it cuts back to Gelman and Knepper for an extended period. Then it cuts back to, there's three of them waiting there. And I think it's, I get it, another example of Lynch has still got it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And also, I mean, I noted that in my recap as another scene that sort of revolves around the women there and what their reaction is. I think that it kind of has a weird rhyme with the young boy who lives with his drug addicted mother, who sees the car in Dougie's tract house where he takes his prostitute Jade occasionally, when the car blows up, and the kid, like, just kind of silently observes it, you know, from the house. And there's this great shot and of the reflection of the fire in the window over his face, which kind of felt to me like another recapitulation of the thing that happened to Lynch when he was younger, and which he put into Blue Velvet, which is that when he was a child, a neighbor woman came up to him, like, practically in the middle of the night, and she was naked and beaten, it left a profound mark. And I feel like that's kind of, again, what he's exploring in that scene with the boy in the exploding car. So it's kind of like there are people who can have dialogue and maybe be more physically prominent in a scene, but that doesn't necessarily mean the stars of the scene. And I almost feel like what you're talking about with the Belushi and Knepper scene is that, for me, the girls are the stars. And it's in large part because of the way they're posed, how they're photographed, you know, how they look and everything. And, you know, even though they're on screen ostensibly less, they make, for me, the deepest impression on screen. You know, that in of itself is interesting in terms of how it complicates a lot of, I think, the readings of the film's, I guess, you know, gender perspective and everything. And, you know, it's interesting to try and grapple with and get a grapple on. I know no one person is going to see exactly the same thing with that, so.
Also, another character or actor introduced is Tom Sizemore, who I don't know about you guys, but when he was on the cast list, I basically expected him to be a gangster of sorts. But instead, he shows up as one of Dougie's co-workers, and he's actually, I think, pretty great casting in that this is a guy who's typically cast in, like, cop or war films. But instead, he's just playing what feels like a guy who probably played football in high school and grew up to be, like, a bully in the workplace, essentially. I think it was quite good casting.
It's an insurance company, so he's like basically talking about like, was this arson or was it, you know, or was it not, and we need to pay this out and everything. And Dougie, you know, his green suit flashes on his on Sizemore's face, and he's like, he's lying. So I'm assuming there's going to be more, you know, where Dougie and Sizemore maybe come to blows or something like that. Which would be interesting, and I don't quite know what that's going to be. If there's going to be like, you know, a Cooper learns how to fight kind of scene, and I wonder maybe that'll be like the deleted Sheriff Cable Chet Desmond scene in the missing pieces of Partnership with Me. But
I also like that as sort of a reconciling of Dougie's state, Cooper's detective intuition, and whatever strange powers have been gifted him from the Black Lodge. Because it is funny too, because watching the scene, I initially took it as solely a gift passed down from the Black Lodge, and then I thought to myself, well, no, because he's a master detective, right? That's how his brain is trained, and the way it's coming back there, I find really interesting how they seem to be reconciling all these separate forces into one thing, but also how, of course, Dougie doesn't have Cooper's charm or his cunning when he accuses somebody of lying. That was a little thing I liked, a little piece that came in. I want to talk to, there are two moments with regards to the cutting of this episode that I found really fascinating. First, I want to go back to the sequence wherein the car explodes. Now, am I alone, or was the cutting in that really strange, how once the bomb went off, there seemed to be this effect where it's almost as if they evaporated from the air, the men who were in the car? There's something very kind of jagged about the cutting of that sequence. How it, I believe the shot is on the little boy's face as the car blows up, and then it cuts to the car as it's blowing up, and then suddenly they seem to kind of disappear. Later you see that they're on the ground, but the effect of it felt otherworldly in a way that I really wasn't going to anticipate.
Yes. No, and it does, the explosion happens with kind of a light effect on the face of the little boy. And then I guess it kind of, when it cuts back, it's sort of like an editorial stutter in a way, in that I think the car explodes, but then it kind of explodes again when it goes back to the car. And what I gather is that they're kind of like, you know, the people who are there are probably like mannequins or something, where they just don't exist or whatever. And then, you know, it does have this otherworldly kind of thing where it's sort of like, which I love about a lot of effect. It can be achieved digitally, it can be achieved practically, but where, you know, you're looking at an effect, but that actually kind of deepens it in a way and connects you to the context of the film or TV show or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of the magic of editing too. You know, it can, what it can stir in you, you know, you don't have to, it's again, the kind of thing of what I'm talking about, like with the three girls kind of being the three pink dress girls being kind of the main focus for me in the scene with, the two heavies in the casino, it's in the cutting and the presentation as to why that power balance is there. And that's kind of a mysterious thing that's probably arrived at, certainly through some intuition, but I would also think some sculpting, in the sense of, you know, they probably had this footage and, you know, they worked around it. And if there's an effect in the case of the explosion, they probably had that as something of a limitation. But still, you know, it's kind of like you find the exact right mesh of those things to conjure the feeling you want. And you don't necessarily have to see like an explosion full on, or have, say, the three girls, speak, you know, at length, or speak at all necessarily to make an impression. And that's often lost or not really understood, I think, in a lot of filmmaking, and not just modern filmmaking. I mean, you see some of the programmers, you know, back in the day, and they can be deathly dull in terms of, you know, the formulas they stick to, although they're in some ways the formulas being more studio mandated than left to the devices of each individual artist actually probably gave us more of interest than less. You know, and Lynch just has that thing, I guess, where he can experiment and get to that place. And I mean, I should give credit, of course, to the editor, Dwayne Dunham, who is the lead credited editor on this. And there are additional editors, one of whom is Lynch himself. But Dunham's been with Lynch for quite a long time. And so they have a clear rapport that comes through in how they cut things together and in the effects they get out of that.
Dwayne Dunham, the director of the 1993 Rick Moranis comedy Little Giants, you know?
There was a similar effect in the second episode when Cooper kills Matthew Lillard's wife. And when she gets shot, there's kind of this weird stutter as she's falling to the ground. I find it interesting how those moments of violence are being punctuated that way and what I would assume is intentional. But at the same time, I can't surmise what the... quite exactly the intended effect is. But so there's that. I also, you know, looking at the first episodes again, I had sort of forgotten and came to discover that among my favorite moments is the sequence wherein Cooper meets the evolution, the evolved arm, the new man from another place. And the man from another place, or the arm, whatever you want to call it, asks him, do you remember your doppelganger? And the camera does this close-up of McLaughlin. I believe it's essentially, it's this very tight close-up of his face. And there's this look of kind of sadness and resignation and defeat on his face as it cuts to footage from the series finale / season two finale, however exactly you want to qualify it. And it's the footage of the evil doppelganger laughing with Bob. And then it cuts back to McLaughlin, current day, with the same look, sort of this understanding on him. And that, so that is him remembering that moment, basically. That's from his point of view. This episode does a mirror of that, appropriately, when the Alpha Coop is looking in the mirror. And, of course, there, what most people remember about that scene, and memorably so, is the, I guess, the superimposing of Frank Silva's face over Kyle McLaughlin, which gave me a little jolt watching it, because the way that it's composed and the way that it's lit feels so deliberate in how the effect comes about, where you're watching it and you're not quite I personally was not quite sure if this effect was actually taking place or if my mind was sort of filling in something there, which I thought was absolutely beautiful. But he's looking in the mirror, and again, actually, this goes back to the fourth episode as well, when Dougie / Cooper looks in the mirror, and it's presumably the first time he's looked in one in quite some time, and it, of course, mirrors the very end of the original series, et cetera, et cetera. And, okay, to my point. Alpha Coop is looking in the mirror, and suddenly there is the same sequence of the evil doppelganger's creation laughing with Bob. But the way that it's cut is, again, very jagged, very quick. It is playing the same small pieces of footage on a loop over and over. And there was such an uncanny feeling that this sequence gave me, the sense of seeing things from his perspective, or having a sense of how he perceives reality or how he perceives time and incident. And it's the sort of thing that, admittedly, I can't say with certainty how you would work it into a critical overview of this series thus far, except to say that sort of the mirroring, no pun intended, of experiences between good Cooper and bad Cooper strikes me as very deliberate there. And I really love the, sort of almost the, I don't want to say the casual surreal, the casually surreal effect of it, because it's not quite casual, but it's not exactly pronounced either. And I mean, I assume that both of you noticed this as it was playing.
Yes, I would also point out that when Cooper / Dougie looks into the mirror and recalls the end of the series, there is no flashback. So if you were to interpret it as like Cooper when he's Cooper, you know, thinks back. Cooper when he's Alpha thinks back, and they both have this varied perspective on the same thing. But when Cooper is Dougie, who, you know, is effectively a an ineffectual doppelganger, just, you know, a half doppelganger, even, just, you know, kind of made as an avatar. When he looks in the mirror, there is no memory. It doesn't exist. And it doesn't exist except for, I guess the implication would be as, you know, as perhaps a ghost that, you know, the audience has to fill in. You know, in the sense of if we know the series, we know that composition, we know what it means when Cooper looks in a mirror, given the end of the series and what that suggests. And the way McLaughlin, I think, plays it is blank enough that you can kind of, you know, impose that or superimpose that onto his reaction, that he knows should be knowing something, but he can't quite place it. You know, and so, I mean, I don't know how long the whole Dougie thing is going to go on. For all I know, it could be the entire series, which, I, you know, whatever. I'm prepared for anything. But, I mean, what we're in basically now, I feel like this is in some way like David Lynch is giving us a sort of transcendental meditation-esque, like, journey. You know, and Mark Frost is probably thinking it's Arthurian legend kind of quest. You know, of Cooper, you know, regaining himself and relearning himself. And they're doing that at, like, very extended length. And, I mean, I find it thrilling. And, you know, I'm sure it's maddening to many others, especially if you want, you know, speed or immediate gratification or whatever. But that's not this.
Well, there's another Cooper reaction shot I'm curious how you reacted to earlier in the episode when he sees as he's being prepared to go to work in the morning, he sees his son, Sonny Jim Jones, and you cut back to Cooper and you see the single tear, I believe, rolling down his eye. What I wondered if that was supposed to, in a way, rhyme with the him being able to tell Sizemore is lying scene where it's like Cooper can tell something is off, because I don't know if we want to get into Reddit theories, but I think at least the most popular one being passed around is that essentially the Janie and Sonny Jim are plants set up by, or decoys set up by, the Las Vegas people. They're both actors. And one can see it as a scene where, if you want to ascribe to that theory, Cooper is looking at his not real, or Dougie is looking at his not real son, Sonny Jim Jones, and seeing that there's a lie going on, as with Sizemore being deeply removed, just removing the green reflection. So I don't know, what did we make of that scene in terms of at least having to tack on an interpretation? Do you think it's something like that, or do you think it's, again, more just this character getting reacclimatized to the world?
What I love about it is that I thought it was just so implicative and mysterious, and I didn't need it to refer to anything. You know, there are some sequences and interactions where I'm like, oh, this mirrors that, or, you know, this is an interesting thing, and it was arrived at, I suppose, through some subconscious means, but clearly this rhymes with this, and it, you know, they're kind of connected in that way. That just seems so beautifully out of place, even though it's very much of the world nonetheless, that I was kind of happy not to interpret it too much. It was just like, and it was just like, it was nice to just, you know, have him look at the boy sitting kind of morosely in the car, and it just evokes this tear. I would also point out, and this also happened in the Denise Bryson scene, where if you look at the tail ends of that, at the tail end of that scene, if you look at, I think, the last time you see Sonny Jim in the car, there are some, both Denise in her scene and Sonny Jim in his, make some movements that suggest they are actually moving backwards, like in the Red Room. So, which throws an added wrinkle into things. I guess maybe added interpretive stuff. It could also just be, oh, it's, you know, it just adds to the strange aura of things. But I feel like, you know, maybe if I want to interpret that, you know, Dougie/Cooper is not fully in the real world, so he's also occasionally stuttering back into the kind of Red Room world where things happen backwards and at different tempos and such. And I mean, there's some evidence for that too in episode 4 when the one-armed man appears to him in the bedroom and basically tells him that, you know, it's, you know, both you and the evil Cooper are out now, and only one of you can survive. So one of you has to kill the other. But, you know, at the same, you know, that's again one of those expository things that's delivered in such an odd, abstract way that it kind of like that in of itself, you know, upends any kind of interpretive space that I could have there. And I mean, so I like that within an episode where I feel like there are a lot of rhymes and resonances, there's one thing that's especially that just feels like it's its own isolated moment, at least to me.
Mm. For my part, I did not, on my own part, come up with any sort of fan theory regarding Dougie Jones's family, except to say that I thought to myself, if this is in fact his son, then one would think there's something odd going on with the boy, since he is the child of a decoy created by Bob from some sort of material in the Black Lodge, which means he couldn't possibly be a normal child. And I do find it interesting watching the fourth episode again, how he teaches Dougie/Cooper to do the thumbs up, right? And then he sort of guides him along with eating his breakfast, too. And even the emphasis on him as... even the emphasis on him kind of in that scene, the shots on him as he's laughing and smiling and particularly observing, I found intriguing, let's say. And does that lead to something else, some revelation about the character? Well, I certainly have no idea, but one would think that there might be something else going on, especially since I think the end of the episode implies that we're going to be seeing more of the family. But again, who knows what the kid and Naomi Watts' schedules were when they were shooting this, because all of that was so kept under wraps that it can't be assumed quite yet. However, I do wonder if there's something going on with the kid. And then... if nothing else, I just really love that shot of Kyle MacLachlan with the single tear on his face. I thought it was, you know, the thing about this whole series is that I find myself using the words moving and touching a lot more than I would expect to describe it. I am finding the whole experience a very moving one. And I'm finding it just this really, you know, this character who was so the embodiment of a humane, compassionate figure, someone who was an idol to a lot of people when they watched him because of his sense of character, is now rediscovering himself in this way and is getting these new facilities, but also all these people who we haven't seen in so long, how much time is having an effect on them and how much the march of time has been kind of relentless in that way. You know, looking at how suddenly, you know, the last time we saw Shelley Johnson, I think she was sitting in the diner with Bobby having some dialogue, and now we see her, and she has this daughter who's this troubled young girl who's very much like Laura Palmer. And, you know, also, I still think a lot about the last scene of the fourth episode between Albert Rosenfield and Gordon Cole, and how there's kind of, you know, watching it again last night, there is such a palpable sense of hurt and even kind of, I don't want to say resentment, but let's just say a very palpable sense of hurt in Lynch's performance there. How many times he's just repeating the name Albert, the way you kind of repeat someone's name in a conversation when you realize that you've been wronged by them in some way. There's a lot of that going on here, and I think that it's delivering them in kind of these small moments. It's also delivering them in a bit more archly comic moments, such as Bobby seeing Laura Palmer's photo and he's crying and there's the Angelo Badalamenti music playing, and the reverse shot of that is Hawk and Robert Forster, Sheriff Truman, kind of staring at him. Forster in particular having this look of, what are you doing? what exactly is going on here? That hodgepodge of emotional wavelengths, I think I'm finding more rewarding only the further I sit on it. Hmm.
Do we have any concluding notes?
I'm excited for whatever comes next. I have no idea.
Oh, yeah. Actually, I want to make one note about the band we see performing at the Bang Bang Bar. And like Nick, I had a similar experience where Cutback is like, whew, because so much had already happened in the episode that I was like, okay, I guess it's time has gone by that fast. We're getting the concluding performance, but there was still another 10 minutes or so. But I should note the band that performed is David Lynch's son's band, but also I was very excited. I noticed playing the saxophone was Alex Zhang Hung Tai, who's a Taiwanese Canadian musician who I actually know people who knew him when he lived in Montreal. And he, I knew through him that he was a huge Twin Peaks fan, and that he actually, I heard a story, he performed at Lynch's club Silencio in Paris for just an audience of Lynch, and apparently when he was with his former band Dirty Beaches, and it was just Lynch in the crowd going, woo, and smoking cigarettes. So when they released that long cast list last year, I was actually kind of hoping to see him on it, because I'm like, he's such a perfect fit for that universe. So when I saw him on screen, it was great.
Mm. Yeah, it's a nice little tidbit, yeah.
Yeah, I'm waiting for Trent Reznor and his wife to show up so he can get a How to Destroy Angels performance.
Hell
so.
Yeah. You know, I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
Well, we still have until the end of summer, and I think...
We're not even a third of the way through. Yeah.
Jeez. What's even going to happen? Like, I'm trying to picture, like, the beginning of August, where possibly will these episodes be set? Who will be in them? It's, I can't comprehend it. And that's very exciting.
Yeah.
Expect the unexpected. Indeed. But thank you for joining us again, Keith. And you've mentioned that you're doing recaps of the show, but where can we find those?
The recaps are on Movie Notebook. My editor, Danny Kasman, is a lovely guy. He's basically more or less given me carte blanche with them and allows me to not do the quick turnaround recaps that I think kind of some people can do them. I find I need to sleep on things, so I'm happy to have the venue. I really respect Danny on the site, so and I can go really long on the analysis, so I'm happy about that. I'm doing every episode. So we have 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 as their own posts, and I guess by the time this goes up, 5 will have been published. So, yeah.
Anywhere else on the internet we can find you?
Oh, many. So many places. Just type Keith Ulich into Google. That's K-E-I-T-H, last name U-H-L-I-C-H. I'm kind of all over the place. And, I'm also, if you want to get a more collated, list of things, I have my own site, keithulich.com. Give a look-see and just check into the other writing section, and you'll see a lot of the places I write for.
Nick, what about you?
You can find me on thefilmstage.com occasionally. You can find me at twitter.com/Nick_Newman.
And you can find me somewhere in Buenos Aires.
We didn't even talk about that, yeah.
Oh, jeez. There's too much to talk about. we'll have more to say, probably, but I'm sure that it'll come up in an episode or two from now.
Yeah.
Will it?
Well, maybe not until the last 2 hours.
We'll make it work.
Who knows what'll happen. But anyway, thank you again for joining us, Keith.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for listening.